Well, hey everyone, welcome back to the Vinyl Guide Podcast. This is part two of our two-part series featuring a conversation with Chad Kasem of AcousticSounds.com, Analog Productions, Quality Record Pressings, and about a half dozen other audio and vinyl record-related ventures. Now, this here, what you're listening to into your ear holes, is episode number 170 of the Vinyl Guide. If you haven't heard episode number 169, which is part one of this conversation, we strongly urge you to go back and listen to that episode as it will help put the discussion here into context. Hey, if you're going to be a rebel or just completely disregard all customs and recommendations, I can't stop you, nor should I. You're old enough to know better and will likely get your comeuppance at some point in the future, okay? Or, you know, perhaps you'll be rewarded for your innovation and this streak of lawlessness which you insist on exhibiting will actually work to your advantage. I cannot tell you how to live, but I can tell you that AcousticSounds.com is like the epicenter of an online journey for an audiophile, just like the one that is currently sitting behind your eyeballs right now. So make no mistake, there is no greater online mecca for vinyl nerds than AcousticSounds.com. So with that, let's continue with part two of our conversation featuring Chad Kasem of AcousticSounds.com. Now, when it comes to the different labels you deal with, like, for instance, you work with Blue Note, you work with Prestige, you re-release records that were on Impulse, do they all pretty much work the same? They have the master tapes, they provide you the artwork, or are there variations between each label, how you work with them?
Well, we work with all the majors on all different sides. You know, we buy their finished products, we press records for them, and then we buy some of them back from them. They put their music on our Hi-Rez site, and then I license stuff from them. Okay, so, you know, you got Uni, which is the biggest. They own EMI. They own the Beatles. You know, they own Verve. They own Blue Note, which was because they own EMI. EMI owned Capitol. They're the biggest, and then there's Sony that owns RCA and Columbia, and then you got Warner Brothers that, you know, owns Warner Brothers and Rhino and all that. And they're pretty much all alike in a way. You know, some of them are quicker at giving you the license and clearing it, and some of them are quicker at, you know, the different steps, like, some of them are better at this, and that, and the other's better at the other things the other guy isn't as good at. And so each of them have their own things that they're really efficient on, and each of them have things that maybe the other label is more efficient on, you know. But it all balances out, and, you know, you just have to be patient and try to realize that, you know, this is where, you know, the company's great, and this is, they have like a, here's where the road bump is, you know, and, you know, just understand that they're so huge. I mean, listen, I'm telling you this, like, I'm patient and I understand, but there's just nothing you can do but to wait, and, you know, they own it, and they don't have to give it to you, and even though $100,000 might sound like a lot of money to me and you and most people, and it might be a lot for a money for them not to jump on, it's still a big company that moves slowly, you know. And now the artwork, typically where you're responsible for doing your own art, like, they might not even have the original album jacket. So, you know, we go and find the original album jacket, and we have our own graphic designers just scan it. Sometimes we can make it just as good. Sometimes we can make it better. Sometimes Moiré, the Moiré effect, you know, it's almost impossible when you're scanning another jacket to reproduce. So you do the best you can. You work as long as you can on it. And then, you know, all the labels that we deal with know that we only will work from the original master. So 99% of all the things we've reissued on our label is from the original master analog tape. Now, there's a few things we did that were original digital recordings. And so if it was original digital, then that's what it is.
Right.
So and we tell people, we disclose it, you know, hey, the master was digital, but it's a great recording. You know, a good digital is better than bad analog, you know. A good mono is better than bad stereo. I mean, so if it was a digital recording, but everybody loved it, they want it, and it is what it is. So sometimes tapes are lost or destroyed or there's a problem, and then we just have to decide whether we've passed on a lot of jobs that, you know, hey, we can't find the master, or the master doesn't sound that good, or we're not going to let you use the master. We'll just pass.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes if you really know that the master was destroyed and all they have is a what they call an EQ tape copy or a safety copy, but it's a really good copy and it sounds great, and that's the best they can give you because you really know that they're not lying. You know, they're telling you the truth, and then you just make the decision. And so since there's so few of those that happen, and when they come around, we think and we go, well, this is the best we can get, and it sounds great. Let's do it, you know. Or, yeah, it doesn't sound that good, and, you know, you just got to make a decision. But, you know, our reputation is very important, and so we'll pass.
So, for instance, on the White Album remaster that you just pressed, do they send you digital files? Do they send you a master tape? How do they...
They sent the lacquers from Abbey Road.
Okay.
So, yeah, so they just send us the lacquer. And then we press it from there. We send them some test pressings. Now, the two Beatles albums that were done were ones that Giles Martin, the son, just remixed.
Mm-hmm.
So they're the new remixes. Yeah, we really only have, you know, our the only control we have is the plating and the pressing, you know, and the assembly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're our customer. And but we're very proud and feel fortunate that you know, they asked us to be the pressing plant.
Do you find yourself having to bake the tapes sometimes? Do you have that capability to do that in house?
Yeah, we do. That's in our mastering facility. Sometimes the tapes need to be baked. Yeah, there's a certain period of years that I've heard different stories, like they were using different things for a tape in the 50s and 60s, and they stopped using it like in the late 70s and early 80s, I think. Maybe I've heard things like whale oil or things like that that they quit using.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have to do it at a certain temperature and go ahead and work when it's done, work with it right away, you know what I mean? Because if you let it sit again for a while, you might have to bake it again. So it happens.
When it comes to some of the different audiophile pressings you have the UHQRs, there's now the UltraDisc One Step. What are those processes? How are those different than some of the other pressings, some of the other audiophile issues that you've done in the past?
Well, our UHQR, we can do one step on the UHQR if we want, and sometimes we might not. One step is, okay, there's like three steps into plating. You know, you cut into the lacquer, which is called the master, and then they put silver, they coat it, and then they pull that apart. So the lacquer is like, has grooves. You can play it. It's called the master lacquer, and you can play it. And all they sound great. But then, you know, you spray, you know, you make your parts. So when you pull that metal out of the lacquer, now it's sticking out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't play it, so it's a father, you know, a positive. Then they put another, coat it with another layer, and then when they pull those two apart, now that's your mother.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now you can play it again. Then they coat it again, and then that's your stamper. So the grooves are sticking out again. And then that sticks into your record.
Yeah.
Well, the one step is you eliminate those and you just use the first father. You know, like you take your lacquer, and then when you plate that lacquer and you pull that first part off,
that becomes
your stamper.
Okay.
Right, but it'll only last, like what we said, the 500 to 1,000, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have to cut the record again. So now we're doing the Hendrix UHQR, but, you know, when I explained it to the label owner, they didn't want the expense or to run the master tape 6 times in a row, you know, or it might be 10 times.
Right, right.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Now, is it better? It probably is a bit, like, to what degree? Well, you know, that's debatable, but, you know, we have our own plating. So, I mean, we can do any of that, and we will do that on some jobs,
mm-hmm.
you know. So, but anyway, the UHQR stands for Ultra High Quality Record. And what we do with our UHQR is we use the fine-built manual press.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you look at an automatic machine, most of the automatic machines have motors that are connected to the press that vibrate. And so, why? It's just like if you're playing a record on your turntable, and I walked over there and I started shaking the stand your turntable's on while you're playing a record. That's not going to improve the sound, right?
That's right.
Well, why have a motor connected to the press that's vibrating the press while you're making a record? So we separated all of the motors or anything that vibrates off the press and put them on industrial pucks, you know, like isolation pucks, but industrial.
Mm-hmm.
And we separated them and moved them over and put them on pucks. Well, we did that on our automatic machines. Well, they still vibrate. There's other things that vibrate on them. But the manual machine, there's nothing that vibrates. And the cycle is way longer. And it leaves a way better impression.
Mm-hmm.
Then we also use what's called a flat profile. Well, a flat profile means there's no incline. So when you put your needle down, it travels perfectly straight across. There's no, most records, your cartridge is kind of riding up a hill a bit. You know what I mean?
Okay.
It's not like if it's linear or like a regular tone norm. I'm talking more just the profile of the record itself, the flatness of a record. Okay, so what they did back in the old days is when they started having record changers is there's two reasons why they have what's called a groove guard. At the end of all your records, you know, the lead-in groove, you know, pretty much where you put your fingers,
mm-hmm.
That's called a groove guard right there. And it's like a beaded edge, and it's higher than where the music starts, okay? Then it's higher, and it goes down, and then the music starts, and then it gradually rises up until the label. And then when the records fall on top of one another, the label's higher, and the groove guard is higher,
mm-hmm.
okay? And that keeps the grooves from touching. Now, they did that, I think, back when they had record changers. So, like, you know, you remember the record changers, they fall on...
Yeah, so
right.
It gives it a little bit of a cushion almost.
Right, it keeps the grooves from touching. Now, that might also help when you're pressing records, because when you're pressing them, they're falling on top of each other. Now, they're not spinning, but it keeps the grooves from touching. Well, before that, the other thing that's good about the groove guard is it puts a back pressure when you're pressing the vinyl. The press wants to squeeze the vinyl all the way out.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And if there's no groove guard and it's a flat edge, the vinyl just wants to keep shooting out. You know, there's nothing keeping it inside as much. So it makes it harder to press a good record. But we've come up with a way to have a little bit of a groove guard and still have a flat profile. So when you play a UHQR, it's the cartridge isn't going up an incline at all. It's going just straight, you know. And so hopefully I explained that right. And that's why the flat profile is important. And so what we do is we use a manual machine. The it gets a better impression. The cycle of the record, meaning it presses a lot longer. There's no vibration. It's a flat profile. Mm-hmm. It's done by hand. The person running the press pulls it off and inspects each one by hand. You know what I mean? By eye right there. It's inspected later on as well. Oh, and also we use Clarity Vinyl, which has no black carbon in it. And carbon is a dye.
That's interesting because I've heard that black vinyl is the purest form of vinyl, and it sounds like that may be mistaken.
Right, it is. The pure vinyl comes, it's off-white. It's the same, it's like the color of the Clarity Vinyl. So it comes that way, and then the black is added as a dye. So if you go and read about, there's a certain kind of beetle, and when they were making shellac records, they used the secretion of a beetle or a bug that might be similar to a beetle. And that's how they got their black pigment from that bug. And then when they changed from shellac to vinyl, they quit using that secretion of the beetle. They went to carbon. Well, carbon is a real fine powder, and it's put in there to make it black, you know. And, you know, and our records have been black ever since. You know, nobody questions it. I mean, it can be any color, but we're like, well, why add anything impurities to it? So, you know, the clarity that we trademarked is pure vinyl before there's any impurities put into it. It's what they call their natural product. So that's another thing we do.
Is the black almost like a filler as well? Like I would imagine clarity vinyl, if that's its purest form, adding carbon in it adds expense. So, or does that carbon, does that black color help fill it out? It makes, you know.
No, I don't know.
I'm almost thinking Scarface, you know. He gets a pure shipment in and then he cuts it with something and makes it twice as big. So that's not what is happening.
Right, no. I mean, I understand why you would think that, and in a way I understand, but the clarity actually costs more. Now, I don't know the reason. I could ask him, like, it's probably because they only make a little bit and it's for us.
Right.
You know, so they probably have to stop the process to, all right, now listen, man, you know, you got to get, that's the other thing is, if you get black mixed into the white, one little pellet will ruin a record. Mm-hmm. Or it'll have a black spot in it, right?
Right.
So when you know, they probably have to clean their machines. You know, one little pellet is so small, but you have to have, so it could be that reason, or that we buy it in small quantities. Mm. But the carbon isn't really like, I don't think, a cut, or it's probably not that much cheaper than vinyl. And it may not take a whole lot of carbon to fill vinyl. I mean, those are good questions that I'll probably ask the guy the next time. But I don't think that the carbon's cheaper than vinyl, or people expect black records, they're making black vinyl using the carbon, and to make us our clarity vinyl, they probably have to, you know, it's a hassle for them more, you know, because they're just so used to making the one.
Now, it sounds like quality record pressing, I mean, the focus is obviously in its name, quality. You know, you go through all those different steps. You're focused on in-house plating. Sound quality is number one. Do you guys also do things like splatter vinyl, swirl vinyls, the things that a lot of the boutique record pressing plants are doing these days?
Yeah, we ain't got time for it, man. I mean, it's just a little bit too fruity for us. I mean, they're cool, and I like it, but you have to, like, take the vinyl puck out at 300 degrees and then, you know, add some pellets of a different color. It's a lot of time.
Right.
You know, and we don't have it. and we're not. We'll press any color you want, and we'll even mix it. You know what I mean? But we're not gonna do like the really where you see some records where they cut yellow and black. You know what I mean? And they cut it right in half, and then they put it on the press that way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we could, but it's you got to focus. There's enough people that'll do that. And then the people that want that usually aren't the people that are wanting that plus the highest quality record. So it's like, come to us for the highest quality. Go to somebody else for the crazy colors.
Stay in your lane.
Yeah.
Now, if we go to some of the other pressings, like I was on acousticsounds.com, I saw one of the Analog Productions pressings, Sonny Rollins Saxophone Colossus, $35 for a 200-gram pressing, which to me is a hell of a deal. Unfortunately, they're sold out. How do you keep these in stock? Is that something that, is just title by title? What's the guidance for when something goes out of print forever or when it gets a repress from Analog Productions?
Well, I mean, sometimes the labels, they license it to you and your contract runs out and you may have 3 years worth of supply left. So, you continue to sell. Sometimes your contract runs out and you run out, and usually they'll extend your contract. Sometimes you run out and you call them and they're like, we have other plans.
Mm-hmm.
So every album's a different situation, every label's a different situation, and sometimes we just run out. And then it might not be repressed because it's not as high as priority as another record that we need repressed.
Right.
Or else we got to get, 50,000 Beatles albums out and I'll make a decision. Is my record go before theirs or, so basically, what I tell people, man, is basically every record that you think's in print or that's available right now, it's really out of print. You just got to figure it's out of print.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it really is. Some of them may get repressed. Yeah, but then if you wait again and you don't get it the second time, I say buy now or cry later.
Yeah, I've learned that lesson the hard way.
We had that Saxophone Colossus for 6 years,
Mm-hmm.
The original of that goes for like $1,000. This thing will smoke it. The original, the jacket, it's the $3 tip-on jacket we use. It's great, it's
got to find one in the secondary market now. And that's why I'm looking to buy this Bill Evans Trio Portrait and Jazz, the UltraDisc one-step version, because an original of those goes for $1,000, and I would imagine that this one, audio-wise, will suit me just fine.
Well, it's a great album. We reissued it on 45 on our label, and that one's out of print, too. And then we did a Bill Evans box set, which is on back order, which, was for $600. You could get all 11 Riverside pressings on 45.
Oh, I see. You need Bill Evans at a very, like a virgin vinyl, high-quality version. I mean, it's to find an original pressing that doesn't have the clicks and the pops is so expensive and so hard to do. So, Bill Evans is an ideal artist for the sort of pressing and production that you guys do. Acoustic Sounds is also getting into reel-to-reel. That is an audiophile format. But what is the size of the market? How many reel-to-reel players are there functioning in the world?
Well, there's a shitload, which is, know how much a shitload is? it's a small amount more than a buttload. But, there's a lot of reel-to-reels, and there's a lot of professional recordings that were used in recording studios. Now, your other what you might be meaning to ask more is how many can you expect to sell?
Yeah, how many can you expect to sell of these reel-to-reels?
I mean, we're selling a couple of hundred of these. We can't keep them in stock. I mean, if I could make them a little bit more faster, we would have sold more. It's a growing thing, man. It's a thing. I can, mm-hmm. And it's awesome. And I have a pressing plant. You know, I don't really want to become a tape pressing plant. You know what I mean? You think, you know, records are take one at a time. It takes forever. And it's not like an automatic robot machine. Mm-hmm. But making tape, that's pretty tough and takes a long time.
I've heard, and confirm or correct, if you can, that due to the recent cassette boom, there's a shortage of raw tape materials.
Well, there's only two tape manufacturers that I know of that exist in the world. One is in York, Pennsylvania, and I'm very good friends with the people at ATR Services. And then there's the one in France, and they call themselves Recording the Masters. And so we buy tape from both of them. So I don't know who's buying where the tape, cassette tape people are buying their tape. But I know that there's a cassette boom as well. And one of the biggest tape cassette duplicators is in the state next to us in Missouri. Mm. You know, it's kind of like vinyl, you know, when the cassettes died, they had all this duplicating machine. I bet you the guy that owns that stuff bought as much as he wanted for little or nothing. He's probably freaking out right now.
Yeah. And now I understand you recently added an additional 13 record presses to the quality record pressing stable?
Well, we added, we bought 13 and we rebuilt 6 of them. You know what I mean? So that mm-hmm. might be confusing. But we have a total of 12 SMT, which is Southern Machine and Tool from Nashville. We have 4 Alpha 2 Lexes, and we have 2 fine-built manual presses. Mm. And that's what makes the UHQR.
And is there much of a backlog now? In past years, the vinyl revival seemed to really challenge a lot of the existing record-pressing plants, but it sounds like there's new plants that have popped up. There's plants like yours that have expanded. So is there much of a wait anymore? Is that an issue?
I mean, we're always behind. It's, you know, maybe this month's better than last month, and next month will be worse than the month. You know what I mean? We always have a job. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, there's never a press waiting for a job. It's good. You know, for everybody. I'm also great friends with what someone may think is our competitor, RTI. Mm-hmm. You know, they help us. If we can help them, we do. But you know, they've been doing it longer. And I used to be one of their best customers. So, you know, I'm friends with the owner, and they're very. A lot of the people in the pressing business. One reason is everybody's so busy, they're not that competitive. They help one another, and they mm-hmm. There's so few people that know the ins and outs of this, man. If people weren't as sharing with their knowledge as they are, you know, it'd be hard to figure out a lot of this stuff. So,
Chad, you're at the center of all these industries. You press records, you produce records. You obviously listen to records, and for the last, I'll say, 30 years or so, you know, you've called the shots quite well. What do you think the future of vinyl and audiophile records is, the next 20 years? What does that look like?
Well, you know, that's a good question. That's a good question for how my daughter will live her life, you know, because, I mean, you know, I don't know, but I don't see it stopping anytime soon. There's great records to be made, and you know, Spotify and streaming and all that is just a whole different thing. It's a different thing for different people at different times. You know, there's enough people that really dig sitting down and you know the experience of pulling out a record and putting it on. You know, and I mean, you turn on the TV and, you know, every Super Bowl commercial that Pepsi's been running for the last 4 or 5 years, has a turntable spinning. You know, almost every commercial you see records being played. I mean, not that I go by that to decide, you know, how good the business is going to be, but I mean, when you start seeing McDonald's and Burger King and, you know, Pepsi have turntables in their commercial, I mean, it kind of opens you up. You know, you're like, damn. Or you go to Whole Foods, or you go to a mall and there's opening record stores. I mean,
vinyl is certainly a cultural touchstone. And there's an affinity, there's an appreciation, and a recognition of something really cool and unique about vinyl records. One thing that's kind of striking me is with the business you're doing in audiophile pressings, what that does to some of the collectability of, for instance, the Bill Evans records. Because in the past, you've had to find a copy of Portraits in Jazz, a near mint copy, to have that experience, pay hundreds, if not thousands of dollars for it. Now you can go to acousticsounds.com, order you one up that probably sounds better than the original, but now people don't need to seek out those original pressings anymore when they could get.
Yeah, but you know, there was never that many original mint pressings to begin with, so there's still enough people. Like, I mean, you're probably like me. I want them both.
Yeah.
Okay. Now I'm not gonna go crazy. It's, you know, I'll spend a good amount. I'll spend a good amount, but you're right. Now that I know. You know, I know what went into the sausage on the ones we remastered. You know what I mean? I know how much better it is than the original. But I the original is still the original, and it's collectible, and it's cool. You know what I mean? And so there's still enough people that buy the originals, but most of them are scratchy anyway, you know? So it doesn't kill the market. Yeah, they might not be as valuable. I mean, shit, when ours go out of print, they become as valuable as the original, too, you know? So it doesn't kill the market. The people that like, you know, the 64 Mustang, and there's people that like the new Mustang, and then there's people that like both. Mm-hmm. You know, and since there wasn't that many of the originals anyway, and each record's different, you know. When Classic, in 1994, when Classic Records started, and they started reissuing the RCAs, nobody could get the rights to the RCA, and Mike Hobson did, and he knocked it out of the park, and he really did something nobody could do, and the RCAs were going for $200, $300, $400, $500, $600 a piece, some $1,000 a piece. Now, this is in 1994. Two or something money, and they didn't accept the reissues well. They were a little bit brighter, but they were just, now all of a sudden people were hearing the tape sounds, and they might have been cut a little bit brighter than they should have, maybe some, but it was mostly people weren't just used to hearing it that clear. So, you know, they had a lot of the old people that invested all this money in the originals that were kind of like, oh, well, the originals are better. Yeah, they might have been better in a bit, in some ways, but the new ones were so much clearer, and they were $30. You know what I mean? And the original has got ticks and pops and some scratches, and they're $500. You know what I mean? And so it was mostly, it almost seemed like the collectors didn't want, how could the originals not be better? And they were kind of like negative, you know, to the reissues. But it didn't take long, man, and now people don't really buy the originals. They did kind of, people aren't as interested, or they're not hell-bent, because when it was the originals, the only way you could get it, so you had everybody looking, whether they were audiophile or not, if they wanted that album, you know, they had to pay. And so now they have choices. So, yeah, it did. The prices did come down, but still some. If you got a, you know, we have an original Witch's Brew now on the web for $650. I'd say it's reasonable. And I say I'm surprised it's still there, because it is really rare to get a 1S, 1S, but it still has a bit of noise. And I could sell you a copy for $35 that probably every bit as good in almost every way. But we'll sell the one for $650. If there's one thing I can guarantee you, I can guarantee you that. You know, your question, how do I think vinyl? I'd say the next 10 years will be good years for us, man. I don't know if I can, but I can tell you the 10 after that, vinyl is not going to die. Mm-hmm. And what if it goes back to the way it was in 1995? I go back from 100 employees back to 10. Hey, man, we were doing good then. You know what I mean? People were buying albums. I was happy. They were happy. You know, maybe the part about young people getting into it, that goes down. Well, there was always the diehards, you know. So, but I mean, what do you think?
Well, I believe that that just like you, vinyl will continue on. I think it'll stabilize. It'll get some new converts, but also things like 3D printing and different technologies are going to empower people to be able to even create them at home at some point. And they may not have they certainly won't have the sort of quality that you're used to in your shop, at least not in this century. But I think in the future, you could potentially do something very similar to that.
Right. I mean, it's just like presses. You can buy a printing press for pretty cheap right now, at least to use one. But I mean, you know, everybody's going digital printing. Mm-hmm. Man, we wanted a four-color press, man. You know, it's as big as a yacht, you know what I mean? But it's heavy. But, you know, you can't beat a sheet-fed press.
Right.
And so, yeah, we happy about, man, it's just unbelievable what happened and what's happening, what continues to happen and what's going to happen in the future. And I'm the luckiest man alive. I mean, it's not that the quality wasn't there and that I didn't believe in it, because I did. I put every dollar, every cent, I'm still doing it, into keeping this going, because I love it and I believe it and I want to improve it. But did I really know that, you know, high school kids would be buying it again? No, I didn't. But I didn't do, I couldn't have worked any harder or done any more than I did. It's like I knew that was going to happen.
You followed your ears. And, Chad, I'm going to have to let you go. Thank you so much for taking the time here and sharing all the history and all the techniques and the details here on the Vinyl Guide. I want to remind folks they can go to acousticsounds.com, stock up on audiophile pressings, grab one of those Bill Evans while they're available. That's a real special one that I'm going to grab myself. And, you know, I look forward to having you on the show in the future. And if I ever get out to Salina, Kansas, I'll be happy to buy you a beer.
All right, dude. Well, I'll just get me a hot tea, man. I'll be good.
Okay.
You know, I'll break out when I drink. Jails, teeth, and wind is so.
Oh, okay. All right, fair
enough.
Yeah,
I'm one of those. Hey, thanks for doing what you do, man. I mean, really, we all got to do it together to, get this word out.
All right. Cheers, man. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
All right, there we go. Ladies and gentlemen, Chad Kasem of Acoustic Sounds, Analog Productions, Quality Record Pressing, Vinyl Vault. Boy, all sorts of different ventures. Again, just go to acousticsounds.com. That is your starting point. All right, it was a big week. Double episode week. You're welcome. No, I'm kidding. I'm just
goofy right now. I'm goofy. I'm hopped up on coffee and caffeine and just delirious from mixing all these episodes at once. We've got a ton of great episodes and interviews coming. I mean, hell, we already have 170-something episodes online at thevinylguide.com. However, we've got more coming, and I'm hoping to have another one out to you next week. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.